This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the Marvel Age podcast featuring the Sarcastic Four, episode 12, 1969, part 1.
But the Spider-Man is not really the way things are.
Oh, he is. You see...
Wait till Hunter Thompson gets out here.
He's not the way... No. Spider-Man actor... Look, you know Woody Allen. I mean, you know he's for real. Well, I always thought if Woody Allen were a superhero, he'd be Spider-Man. You see? And, or if I were a superhero, because nothing ever turns out right for me. I mean, I got here, for instance, tonight. I got here 4 hours too early. They didn't serve dinner in my... I thought I'd stay in the room and not get in trouble or anything. They didn't serve dinner till 5 minutes before the fella called and says, you got to be here in 5 minutes. So I just had time to take one mouthful of something and race over here so I could wait for an hour backstage, you see?
Right.
And this is what would happen to Spider-Man or to Woody Allen. It's what? Real.
What? No, Spider-Man would fly over, wouldn't he?
How do you think I got here?
How does Spider-Man fly?
Don't you laugh. I'm going to sing next.
How does Spider-Man fly? I really... Spider-Man fascinates me. And then there's more of your characters I want to talk about.
Our books at Marvel Comics, if I may say that, because people may have forgotten. Our books at Marvel Comics...
I've said it twice already, and once in introducing... Your books where?
Every couple of minutes, you promised.
Okay.
We try to be... very scientific and very accurate about everything we do. Now, for example, I can't have Spider-Man flying through the air like certain other guys who wear capes and big letters on their chest. So I wanted to be scientific about it. So he shoots webbing out from a little wrist thing he has, and he can shoot at any distance. There could be a building a mile away. Somehow it hits the building, sticks to the building. He swings on it like Tarzan. Perfectly scientific and logical. And that's why our books are beloved by science students and professors and the like.
Place to Be Nation Pop, welcome back to the Marvel Age podcast. I, of course, am your host, Nick Duke. We are here once again on our year-by-year journey through the Marvel Universe's entire publishing history, or rather, the most important stories from each year in the Marvel Universe's entire publishing history. And we have made it all the way up to that most magical of years, 1969. But much like every episode of the Marvel Age podcast, I do not come alone. With me, as always, are the other members of the Sarcastic Four, beginning with the other half of the Southern contingent on this show, where the sickness has set in, Mr. Russell Sellers. Russell, how are you doing tonight?
I'm not doing the disturbed thing, although I am very down on some sickness right now, so just hoping the voice holds out to the end.
Yeah, anybody who's had an opportunity to listen to the most recent Hard Traveling Fanboys episode knows that something's going around down here in these parts, and Russell and I both have come down with it, unfortunately. Hopefully doing better than we are is Mr. Tim Capel. Tim, how are you tonight?
Yes, while I am somewhat part of the Southern contingent as well, I'm a little bit further north, and I am encased in a plasticine barrier, so I guess I've been lucky not to have caught whatever is going around down there. Could be something, could be nothing, but good to be here tonight, and we're gonna do our best.
Mm-hmm. As we always do. Actually, that's a lie, but... Rounding out the Sarcastic Four is, of course, the West Coast contingent. There is no sickness out there because, as we all know, it's a utopia, foot free of any societal problems or medical issues. Todd Weber, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing wonderfully here in sunny California, where we have a two-week-long rainstorm that we're in the middle of.
And
I am fresh from my Purell bath and ready to podcast.
Mm-hmm. A Purell bath, you know, that is audio porn to the ears of David Sunday, if there ever was any. So David, just pause the podcast right now, give that a thought of Todd and the Purell bath, and come back to us when you're done in about 25 seconds.
He just composed a jingle for it.
He did. Mm. In any event,
that could be an ASMR role play, you know.
Could be. Could
a lot of money Todd in that. Todd
rubbing the Purell into his skin.
That's right.
Oh, what are we doing already? All right, so
I want to laugh, but it hurts too much.
Yeah, that's kind of where I am a little bit as well, which always makes me laugh harder.
That's a metaphor for life, right now.
Indeed, it is. As we do each and every time we start discussion on a new year, let's kick things off here with just some general thoughts on where we are at this point in the project and kind of what we're looking for going in to 1969. For me, first thing that jumped out to me about this list, two things. A lot of Thor on it, more Thor than we've had in quite some time. So that automatically got me really excited to see how that was going to affect the landscape in 1969. And also something we're not even going to talk about in this episode, but we'll talk about next time, Jim Steranko on art for Captain America. We had effusive praise for Steranko and his Nick Fury work last time out, so I'm pumped to get to that down the road here. Todd, what about you? What were you looking for and looking forward to coming into this 1969 discussion?
I was looking forward to, like I often am, an infusion of new talent to the Marvel bullpen and seeing what Stan and company do with these characters that have been kind of hitting full stride for years, like Spider-Man, Fantastic Four, Thor, and keeping them interesting and relevant for the young readers of Marvel in the late 60s.
Tim, what were you looking for out of this latest year?
Pretty similar to that. I will say I am actually still very much looking forward to the debut of one artist in particular we won't get to talk about on this installment of 1969, but coming up, also more Jim Steranko art. We talked about how Jim Steranko is really in and out of Marvel and his sort of superhero career, and I feel like this is going to be the last year we see any real contributions from him. So all that is to say, these are things we won't be talking about tonight, but I was looking forward to in reviewing our reading list.
So absolutely, you know, lots of good stuff coming tonight, none of which Tim was looking forward to. So a ringing endorsement for the reading list tonight, if there ever was one. Russell, what about you? What were you looking forward to coming into 1969?
Hey, let's keep going on that whole theme of stuff we're not going to talk about tonight. And and mention Neil Adams is going to be on Uncanny X-Men. Mm-hmm. That'd be the one.
Yeah, damn you. Spoiler alert.
The great Neil Adams. And if you ever doubt how great he is, just ask him. He'll tell you.
He'll tell you. But we also get, you know, Thor versus Galactus, which is something that just saying that out loud sounds tremendous. The idea of Jack Kirby drawing that had me excited from the jump. So I'm ready for more Jack Kirby Thor. The more of that I get, the better.
Well, you know, that I'm glad you're excited about that, because we're not going to talk about that right now. We're going to save that for the very end of this podcast. So we have to suffer for our art a bit at first.
We can't just skip to that part because nobody cares about what's about to happen.
No, I don't think we can. And I think you're being overly harsh a little bit, at least as it relates to the first thing that we're going to talk about. And that is Amazing Spider-Man. We're going to check in with Peter Parker and talk about a two-issue story that is fairly well-regarded in history. I think it's something that is...
I thought you were going to go to Hulk first, so that's why nobody cares about that.
We're going to lead off with The Amazing Spider-Man 68 and 69. This, of course, is the classic Crisis on Campus storyline that is still kind of pointed to as one of the most notable examples of early Silver Age comic. You would still call it Silver Age at this point, but... trying to be a bit political, a bit of a reflection of society in the pages of this story. And so I'll start off here and just say I really enjoyed this. I don't think it was as great as some of the other Spider-Man stuff we've read. I think the political aspect of it probably has been overblown a bit in the decades since. But at the time, I'm sure it was revolutionary to see any kind of content like that at all in the comic. And the conflict with the Kingpin was fine enough. I enjoyed that. Has that mythical tablet that has kind of played a role in like the ultimate interpretation of Kingpin and has come pop back up several other times in the Spider-Man mythos as well. So I'll say all that to say I continue to enjoy Amazing Spider-Man. John Romita, continues to do a great job, and Stan, you know, kind of scaling back on his writing, but still keeping the reins of Spider-Man, managing to keep the momentum going for that title. Tim. What were your thoughts here on this Crisis on Campus story?
Well, I found it really incomprehensible since comics were not political until 2017.
Yeah.
So I didn't understand what I was reading and didn't understand a word that you just said. But no, I'm not doing that tonight. Yeah, this was pretty solid stuff. Amazing Spider-Man has always been such a consistent outing in the times that we've checked in with it, which is pretty consistently throughout this project. And yeah, we're getting another look at that college-aged, the ESU crowd of Peter and the gang, which is always appreciated and a lot of fun. Good John Romita artwork here, very solid as always. Got a pretty notable intro and Randy Robertson, right?
Yeah.
So he's someone who's going to become kind of a new regular, sort of a new cast member introduced now to this soap opera of sorts we're seeing in the Spidey title. Kingpin hulking out. Get to see his physical prowess.
Including the it's not fat, it's muscle line.
Yes.
Exactly what his physique is.
Solid muscle. Yeah. So strong, in fact, that his vault of secrets does not actually have a lock. It's just a heavy door. How Silver Age is this, right? Yeah. We think this is 1969. We're sort of kind of headed away from the very kind of corny Silver Age tropes. But right here we see, my God, you can't get more Silver Age than that. A mention of his wife as well, which
you beat me to it. Yes,
flies into a rage. Although
Vanessa,
we do not get a great Vanessa name drop here. So I guess that'll have to wait. But yeah, good stuff. I liked how, I mean, we joke about the social politics here and the campus protest, which, I mean, honestly, it feels kind of quaint by today's standards, but
yes,
you have to figure this was probably pretty topical, pretty timely stuff for the late 60s. There is a racial undertone to it as well that Stan, yeah, and John Romita do not shy away from, which is kind of impressive. So
yeah, Randy, yeah, is called an Uncle Tom at one point directly in the pages of the book, which is interesting. And
Peter's called Whitey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. So, yeah, it's using this as a springboard for the actual plot, which is Kingpin using this demonstration to his advantage to cause a distraction and get that tablet, the aforementioned tablet. So I thought it came together very, very nicely. It didn't feel like this is something just thrown in here for shits and grins. Aunt May is on her deathbed again. We need to point that out.
Oh my God. How many times? Like, how long has this lady been on her deathbed?
We really should have kept a running tally when we started this show.
the more early Spider-Man I read, the more angered I become by the events of One More Day, because it's like, this lady has been on her deathbed for 5 decades and you decided to trade your marriage for like a couple more years of this. This sucks, dude.
Yeah.
One other
She was dodging bullets until she wasn't. So yeah. I mean, you got to figure they had a good run. But and this is just the issues we've read. I mean, how many issues do you think have we not read where she is, you know, fallen out or in the hospital or gravely ill, whatever the case may be. I mean, we could take a drink, but we really should have kept track of this.
That's true. We really should have. Also interesting to note that it seems like in between the issues we've read that he and Gwen are growing closer and closer together. Not so much the kind of love triangle. It seems like he and Gwen are kind of narrowing in on each other, mm-hmm, at least based on the implications given in this story. Mm-hmm. Todd, what'd you make of this little Crisis on Campus two-parter?
Yeah, like I said earlier, mid-stride Spider-Man. We've got more of the ESU crowd. I don't know if you can hear me. There we go. I can hear myself now. We've got a lot of father figures being introduced here for Peter. I know we've had Joe Robertson before, but now we're really seeing kind of a focus on him. And we've got Captain Stacy, which we haven't spoken of either. And we know they're father figures because they are smoking pipes. The good men smoke pipes. The bad men smoke either cigars or cigarettes with a plastic cigarette holder. So adults smoke in Spider-Man comics, according to Stan Lee and John Romita. Wonderful art. Standard Stan storytelling. There we go. There has that for alliteration. I liked the de facto Black Panther. And I don't mean the guy from Wakanda. I mean the political Black Panther. But his name is Josh. And so we don't have a lot of radical African-American protesters named Josh in comics. So he also seemed to be about 10 years older than the rest of the students here at Empire State who are protesting changing of one of the halls, the exhibition hall, into a dorm. Or did I get that wrong? Did I get that backwards?
Oh, yeah, they're going to turn it into an alumni housing campus, it sounds like. And they're saying, no, this should be set aside, reserved for underprivileged, right, less fortunate students in affordable housing type of dorm.
So this is kind of interesting. I mean, this is about 6 months before the – well, maybe a year before the Kent State shootings. We're getting a lot more political as far as young people go in the country. It was just past the 68 elections. But we're still kind of looking at this through Stan Lee's 50-year-old version of things, you know, his lens. But – It's compared to everything else, yes, absolutely politically aware. Interesting storytelling. I love the Gwen Stacy stuff. Mary Jane is absent, but we do see Anna Watson, and we do talk about Mary Jane. Still very solid, and I enjoyed these two particular issues. They were just coming off I was reading some of the earlier books of this year where they had a weird Mysterio story that I wasn't thrilled with. But that led directly into the two-part version of the Crisis on Campus. And one thing I forgot, we did have this little fight scene with a shirtless Spider-Man that was rather unique, shall we say.
The web dummy, which was kind of cool. He built the dummy out of webbing and sent him into the Kingpin's lair so that they would think he had headed in and fallen into their trap, and then here he comes busting through the window. Yeah, that was kind of cool.
Kind of creepy, too. It almost felt like something Ditko would have done, just in terms of how unusual it was.
Yeah. Russell, we haven't heard
just
from
you. Just
doesn't
look right.
Sorry.
Oh, it's okay. Go for it.
Yeah, haven't heard from you yet, Russell, on this Crisis on Campus story. What were your thoughts here?
Yeah, I was like Tim. I was like, wait a minute. When did comics weren't supposed to be political until the – at least the 2010s. What is this? This is insane. But no, it's as you guys have already pointed out, it's kind of quaint because it doesn't go hard into the political side of things. It brings it up and it uses it as a storytelling method, but it stops short of showing how the police response probably would have actually been, especially where African American protesters would have been concerned. Nobody's getting hosed or beaten, in other words. But they do have a scene and panel in the first part on page 12 where a security guard is going for his gun. Peter calls him out on it. Mm-hmm. He's like, hey, hold on. These are people protesting. These are unarmed civilians. What are you doing? And apparently the officer still pulls his gun but doesn't use it. So I guess that's probably as much as Stan and John could actually work into the book before somebody would call them out and say, hey, wait a minute, we can't have you showing that in a comic. So it's going to go as far as it can for the day, and I thought that it was presented really well and steers into what the political climate of the day would have been. This fits very much in line with, you know, late 60s politics and how, as Todd pointed out, the young folks were becoming more and more politically active and aware. The Kingpin stuff, you know, it largely works. It kind of is what it is. To me, it doesn't feel like there's all that much to it. It's just kind of fun to, you know, have Peter and the Fat Man going at it again, which is, you know, a pretty par for the course in Amazing Spider-Man in the 60s. Stan very much is keeping a tight rein on Spider-Man. You can tell, and at this point, he is determining where this book goes. And while he's starting to trust other people with the other titles and letting them kind of take a little bit more ownership, he is definitely not going to let go of the what is certainly the major cash cow for them at this point.
Absolutely.
If I may,
yes.
Did they mention Vietnam at all during these two issues?
I didn't catch any references.
No, they did not.
So probably intentional. I mean, that would have made it even more controversial. But just think about the mindset of people at this time. Most of your comic book readers are young men young men. People going to Vietnam, or if you were lucky enough to go to college or be not the oldest in your family or just where your draft card came out. So and I also have to wonder, you know, were comics being read overseas by our soldiers like they used to be? You know, you always see the cliche of World War II soldiers reading Golden Age comics, and I don't know if that was going on during Vietnam conflict, but you know, I just think this is a very interesting thing, a very topical attempt by Stan to say, okay, this is we're thinking of you. There's all is not well. Nobody's happy about these situations. Maybe you'll relate to this. You know, writing it for the soldiers over there. I don't know. And we probably will never get an answer to that with Stan being dead. But it's interesting to think about. Just my dad was he served during Vietnam. He was never stationed over there. And I just think about people who were that age during that time. You know, my dad was 23 in 1969. So yeah, crazy stuff.
Well, and Stan Lee was also doing the college speaking tours around this time, too. So you figure if he's doing Q&As with actual college students, these are the kinds of questions and topics he's getting hit with. And I think he's kind of shrewd in a way. I'm being kind when I say that. And having not choose sides here, you know, where he kind of gets pulled into this thing. He has the link, the immediate link to the protesters and Randy Robertson, who's the son of this mentor figure, father figure he looks up to, but he's still kind of like, hey, I'm not going to just throw in with you guys without understanding the issue fully. But as you said, Todd, we don't really get an answer. Where does he stand one way or the other on this, on something like Vietnam, on these heady issues of the day? So, I mean, we do have Flash Thompson, I guess, overseas, right? He's a soldier, hasn't appeared in these issues for a while, but I don't think we really chronicle a lot of his wartime adventures, if you will, other than, you know, he comes back. They don't get into the social aspect of it really with Flash when he does come back around. So, yeah, I mean, clearly the problem, you know, looking back on this, you see that these baby boomers, this generation, just they're so coddled, you know, whining about student housing and just contributing to our nanny state that, you know, the country is wait a minute.
But,
1969.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In 1969. Are you saying they're snowflakes, Tim?
Far be it from me. Perish forbid.
Well done, sir. All right. Anything else anybody wants to bring up here from these two Spider-Man issues before we move on?
Just wanted to echo what you mentioned about Gwen being more prominent now and the relationship between her and Peter seeming to be the one that Stan has narrowed his focus to, instead of having it be like, who is Peter going to wind up with, Gwen or Mary Jane? We also see Gwen getting a little bit more character in this book too, in her interactions with her dad, and interactions.
She decks that guy.
Yeah,
she decks that guy for talking shit about Peter, which was
awesome.
Like Gwen is really starting to really evolve as a character, and I think Stan has finally like really found a voice for her, and I'm very much looking forward to seeing what else he does with this character and with that relationship as we get further on. Well, as we get into the 70s.
Awesome. Well, moving forward from something that was pretty good to something that wasn't, quite frankly. Let's talk about The Incredible Hulk in 1969.
No.
We picked up. We have to. It's on our list. We have.
Meh.
We must do what we must do, Russell. We talked a little bit about The Hulk in 1968, and I think we wound up enjoying it more than we thought we would, based largely on the fact that it was a pseudo-Thor crossover that found the Hulk in Asgard and doing some interesting things there. This time, we get a more Earthbound Hulk that is back to a traditional Hulk setting where he's on the run from General Thunderbolt Ross, and the leader plays into it. And we have a three-issue story but in 60 Silver Age comics, which is feels like a fucking eternity of just the leader trying to encase the Hulk in some sort of cave and goo, some sort of living cage. I don't know. And Betty Ross is crying and no one cares. I could have seen this guy's
wasn't a metaphor for a vagina.
I mean, I don't know. I'm just saying I could have seen this being a one-issue story, but stretching this to three, man, it felt like decompression in the wrong way here. Was I the only one who looked at it that way?
Clearly
we'll start
not.
With you.
I'm being facetious. It was terrible.
Well, Russell, you seem to have strong feelings, so you go ahead.
No, I'm glad we just kind of skipped right over the Hulk annual.
We'll circle back to
or the king size special, as it were.
Yeah, we'll circle back to that.
First I'll say that I actually did appreciate this trying to find a formula for Hulk going forward that was kind of like, you know, the traditional Hulk formula that we're all used to, him on the run and everything. But this story could have been told in like 1.5 issues, I think. We did not need.
I'd have bumped it back to one,
or just to one. Yeah, one issue. You could have been done with this. We did not need this to go on and on and on like it did. The leader suddenly it's basically like he walks in and just says, "Oh well, you should trust me." And General Ross is like, "Oh well, I don't, but okay, I will anyway." I mean, that's what the dialogue boiled down to for me was. This is just ridiculous. He's didn't read his first appearance. We only got some callbacks to where he came in, I guess. So again, here we are dropped in with a character that we are just going to have to assume we know enough about to go forward with. And it's, as you said, it is decompressed storytelling, but in the worst way possible. It stretches itself out for its own sake just to say, hey, we got more issues of Hulk out. The action scenes are just kind of okay. They don't really, move the earth or anything, even though they kind of quite literally do on the panels a few times. There's not really anything of interest happening in this book. It is just a boring slog that Hulk, I'll sum it up for you. Hulk fights the leader and eventually wins. There you go. That's it. That's all there is to this book.
A solid point. Yeah, it sucked. I don't know what else to say. Tim, do you have anything to add here?
I was giving some thought to the whole what's the Hulk's formula? Like, what's supposed to be the hook here? I think you can get away with this type of decompressed storyline if you have a pretty solid foundation in the first place. Like, you have good, interesting characters that people are going to care about and engage with, and maybe you can do some quiet, introspective character type writing. And, I mean, that's so far from what we see here. And I think part of the problem is the Hulk is he's supposed to be like the destination, not the journey, right? And we get so much Hulk here. There's no Bruce Banner. You really need that if you're doing this version of the Hulk, which I think this is the version of the Hulk I'm thinking of, you kind of need Banner to move the actual story along. And without him here, it's like we're trying to rely on the Hulk as our protagonist, and he's just so inherently boring and limiting as a protagonist that you're basically tying yourself up as a storyteller. It does not help that Betty Ross here is written as such a complete imbecile. This really felt like a step back. You know, this does not feel like, not that we've made tremendous strides in how female characters are presented and written in these comics, but this really felt like a 1962 comic. You have General Ross and Glenn Talbot almost coming across as sympathetically, which I don't think is the intent, but they sort of almost look like they are in the right here, and that is just completely like not what I think I should be getting out of Incredible Hulk comics. So it's just, it's really ass backwards. I had a hard time with this three-parter. While I didn't think it was as egregious as something else we will talk about, no.
Man, Todd, care to make a clean sweep on shitting on this three-part Hulk story?
This is crap. This is not my favorite. Whoops, I dropped my dumbbell. I was lifting weights while Russell and how's that for a humble brag?
The Hulk just
Russell and Tim were talking. I had mute on and I was curling. But let's talk about these comics. These are weird late 60s Hulk comics drawn by Herb Trimpe. Kind of cartoony.
I knew you would bring that up.
Yeah, the art is very different. Especially panel to panel, page to page, it's not bad. The pages are kind of unique. I absolutely hated the villain in this story, who I will call Green Hector Hammond. It was not ideal. You know, the leader is thought of often as the quintessential Hulk villain, but I just don't see it. Samuel Stearns, he's smart. He's got a big gamma irradiated brain. Betty Ross is total gimp here. I snickered when Tim mentioned Glenn Talbot, because the old Hulk cartoon from 1982, which featured Stan Lee narration and ran, I've mentioned the show before, ran as a counterpart to Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, a much better known show. I think the Hulk cartoon only ran for one season, was kind of set in this era of Hulk. Although we didn't see Banner until the very, very end. I think 119, was it 119 or 118? The very end that was transitioning
here. 117, maybe?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we got Betty to calm him down, and he became Banner, and then he was back to the Hulk, and then he was Banner.
Yes, he programmed a missile using some sort of dot matrix paper, it seemed like.
And then he got to ride the missile a la Dr. Strangelove, which was kind of fun. You know? This is not great. Trimpe's still finding his way as an artist. You get Big Head Hulk, which is kind of weird in a book where you have Big Head, the leader. It's a little bit of a drop-off, I'd say, after Marie Severin. But, you know, this is a snapshot to what comics were, Hulk comics were in the day. This is the status quo that I guess I was used to pre-Peter David. And Trimpe was on Hulk for years and years. In fact, drew the first appearance of Wolverine. He drew a lot of the G.I. Joe comics I read when I was a kid. But he is not my favorite artist at this point. This is kind of a simple simpleton type, not simpleton, simplistic, there's the word, simplistic artistic endeavor drawing the Hulk versus the leader here. Tim mentioned Glenn Talbot, and I snickered just because that character has always been kind of my favorite, what's the word, a lackey. He's kind of a lackey to Thunderbolt Ross, who's a dick. And the portrayal of him in the cartoon was really buffoonish, but I do enjoy Adrian Pastar as Glenn Talbot on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. So that's a character
that's right.
We're seeing for the first time here, but he has endured to the modern day, at least as a sometimes effective Marvel nemesis.
Wasn't he also in the Ang Lee Hulk? I'm trying to remember who played him.
Yeah, he blows himself up. I'm trying to remember who played him too.
Josh Lucas.
Yeah, there you go.
It's a name that, you know, you may or may not know.
It sure is a name, yeah.
He's done other things, mostly terrible things.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we even got a Watcher cameo in this in a flashback, which is kind of a trip. But, yeah, this is really – I'm sure there were better comics than these three issues out there. I'm almost certain of it. But, hey, Comic Book Herald, you know the best. So, all right.
Well, and it's weird that at the end of the day, like Hulk – is motivated to free himself from the plasticine condom vagina. And
it was a pizza. It was like a liquid pizza triangle.
But his motivation is, all these innocent people are going to die. And it's just, that's not the Hulk, right? And if it is, it's really sort of breaking him as a character for the sake of making him the sort of traditional heroic protagonist that this type of story calls for, and it feels like a real, maybe that's what they were going for with this character at this time. I don't know, we haven't checked in with them enough to get a good sense of that, but it feels pretty wonky.
I agree. I'll say this though, let's see, these are three issues, about 21 pages each, so that comes out to about 63 pages. I would much rather read these 63 pages again than ever read the 53 pages of the Incredible Hulk King Size Special again. This was also on our reading list. Why was it on our reading list? We don't know, quite frankly, because apparently this came out in 1968, not 1969. So we're not entirely sure why this is on the list, but it is. And we read it. And it sucks. As uninteresting as General Thunderbolt Ross and the leader are bumping up against the Hulk, I would argue the Inhumans and their bizarre political machinations are even less interesting. How many times is Maximus going to make a play for the throne in the course of like 2 years before they finally just off this dude? Because as we open the story, we come in to like the sixth coup d'etat attempt, and I'm just over it, man. Like, I am over this Inhuman bullshit already.
That's
like,
not even the worst.
The interesting Inhumans are Chris and Lockjaw. Those are the two. Those are the only two. And they're Lockjaw barely in this. Crystal nowhere to be found. Fuck this. This is not. I mean, just I don't. It just kept going and going and going, and it felt like 53 pages that felt like, you know, 153 pages. I don't know. I guess because of the Marie Severin participation, it's a little bit better, at least visually, than the three part Hulk story we just talked about, but. All in all, man, this was even more of a slog for me. Todd, what did you make of this?
The only reason that this is on our reading list is that this is one of the 10 greatest comic book covers of all time.
It's a great cover. I'll give you that.
This is a wonderful cover, penciled by, or at least broken down by Severin, but Steranko was the actual cover artist for this. I read an article once where she did the sketch and had the concept, and then he executed it. Yeah, nothing to say. This is the previous Hulk creative team before Lee came back onto the book, and then Trimpy came on to replace Severin, and you know, they were telling fine stories a couple years ago, and this is not a fine story. This is a waste of my time. The less said, the better. So, yeah, go ahead and skip it, but get a poster of that cover for your wall because it's gorgeous.
Right on. Tim?
Yeah, I want to thank Todd for finding the silver lining there, because I think we all would have slept on that very excellent cover otherwise, because this story was insufferable. It is so long. I tapped out after 40 pages. I didn't finish it. It wasn't even an issue of, well, I'm not going to have time or really cutting it close. I couldn't do it. And I just said, I'm putting it down. I'm not going to get anything else out of this. I'm not going to feel worse about it than I already do. And I'm certainly not going to feel better. So this is it. We're calling it a day. It's just me. Once again, if this was a shorter story, I think we could have stomached it, but it keeps going and keeps going and keeps going. I'm like, I cannot believe this is filling the entire length of the annual. Like, I started kind of flipping ahead, you know, as you do, sort of, all right, when is this going to be wrapping up? Got to be soon. And it just wasn't. And I was like, I'm going to blow my brains out here if I have to keep reading this. So I stopped. We were pretty, well, at least I was pretty complimentary of Gary Friedrich's writing as of the last Hulk stuff we covered, which was that little jaunt in Asgard. But that was a real quick story and, you know, knows to get out of there quickly. This, although it's the same sort of setup, fish out of water, totally does not work in the way that did. Part of the problem, I would have to say, is the setting. The Inhumans, for as much as I think kind of current fandom has bitched about how they've been shoved down our throats, perhaps that was somewhat in keeping with their history. I feel like we keep seeing these characters over and over, and fine, but could we try telling a different story once in a while with these guys? Yes, we know Maximus is a douche. Is this really the best we can do with this entire setup? You're talking about an entire hidden race, hidden civilization, and it's just the same stupid, simplistic story over and over. All due respect to Marie Severin, the art, I think, is better than serviceable. The art is quite lovely throughout this entire issue. And to her credit, very consistent for its length, but cannot overcome the terrible, terrible words on the page. So, yeah, I got to say, this may be the worst thing we've read. So don't hold me to it, but that's sort of my impression right now.
Man, I don't know if it's worse than the Ant-Man stuff. I would have to give that some long, although you bring up a good point. It's so damn long, the Ant-Man stuff, which is at least like part of an anthology book. So I'd have to consider.
I would say it's worse than the Ant-Man stuff. That didn't really ever stay its welcome too much.
Russell?
Stop trying to make Inhumans happen, Stan. Oh, that's right. I forgot where I was when I was. The thing is, you know this is going to be crap whenever you spend like the first, I think it's five or six pages here, introducing us to a new group of Inhumans that we've never seen before, giving them all this background to let us know why they're on trial, then letting us sit through the trial.
And they're on trial because Maximus tried to steal the throne again.
I swear to fuck, by page six, I'm already just putting my hands up like, who gives a shit? This is by far, I don't know if I classify it as the worst, but it is easily the most boring thing we have read yet. It took me 2 weeks to finish this. 2 weeks to finish this because it was so mind-numbing. It was just painful to get
mind-numbing through. Is a good way to put it.
That's what it is. This is a go-nowhere story that goes nowhere for 53 pages. And it's all the same story. It'd be one thing if this was like an anthology, you know, change it up a little bit, give us some kind of variety, maybe a palate cleanser. But oh, fuck no, this is Inhumans from beginning to end. And if you don't,
and not even the real Inhumans, like you said, it's a bunch of jobber Inhumans.
Yeah, it's a bunch of Inhumans that we will never see again.
And it would be one thing if it were the Hulk pummeling jobber Inhumans, but instead it's the Hulk like sneaking around the Inhuman city and like making weird alliances with these jobber Inhumans. It makes
the worst use of
the Hulk possible. Yeah, if it were just him destroying people for 53 pages, that would have been awesome.
Yeah, like. Well, you don't even. Well, I guess you could do 53 like splash pages of him just like annihilating every one of these Inhumans, putting them all down, and then you know a big grudge match between Black Bolt and Hulk at the end. That might have been something fun, but oh no, we got to pack in them word balloons, and boy do they. If ever there was a comic that felt like it was about 9 or 10 steps backwards, it's this one. Yeah, the cover, okay, fine. Cover is great. That is a beautiful cover. Please don't read the book. Mm-hmm. Like say, go read those 3 issues of Hulk that we just talked about. As terrible as they are, if you just got to read some Hulk from 1969, you know,
yeah,
okay, I guess. But this is not your bag.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Those 3 issues were better than this, easily, to me anyway.
Oh, for sure.
All right. So with all that being said, I think we've reached a point where we can take a little break here. Be sure to stick with us through the break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little Guardians of the Galaxy and, finally, something really worth talking about on this episode, some Thor in 1969. Stick with us. We'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place Between Nations, Justin Rosero and Chad Campbell here, and we want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we now offer them to you on 2 great feeds. On the Place Between Nations Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, Main Event, Survey Says, Wrestling War Zone, a Monday Night Wars podcast retrospective, No Holds Barred, Jeff Learns Wrestling, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. On top of that, we're also dipping into the vault, re-releasing the entire catalog of Where the Big Boys Play for your enjoyment. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is loaded with great content, offering such tremendous shows covering the land of pop culture, such as Geek and Sassy, Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Sunday Groove, PTBN Play, Freak Out Drive-In, Songs with Friends, Looking Forward, Looking Back, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Conversation Comics, DC Post Crisis Management, Marvel Age, and Marvel Age Masterclass, plus weekly pod blasts that cover the gamut of comic topics. The feed is also filled with insightful sports content, including the NBA team, This Week in the NFL, and more.
You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows plus others available at PlaceToBeNation.com. We cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon while doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
You need cooling, baby, I'm not fooling. I'm gonna send you back to school, way down inside. Honey, you need it. I'm gonna give you my love.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Marvel Age podcast. And we're gonna pick up right where we left off and continue our discussion of 1969 in the Marvel Universe. And we're gonna pick back up with the introduction of a concept that's become very popular in the last, oh, let's say decade or so, especially since the release of 2 movies that have come out, and that's the introduction of the Guardians of the Galaxy in Marvel Super Heroes 18. However, these are not the Guardians you're looking for. Rather than introducing Star-Lord, Gamora, Drax, Rocket Raccoon, and Groot, instead here we have, I'm going to be honest with you, I know the one guy is named Charlie 27, and the rest of them, I did not give a single shit by the end of this. This book was borderline incomprehensible to me. Like, 8 pages in, I'm like, why do I give a shit? And you're telling me that, like, living and being born on Jupiter makes humans look like the Blob?
Over time, my friend.
It just, I had nothing
3,000 years. It's like, the year 3,000.
And we're following this fucking Charlie 27 around for what feels like 40 pages before any of the other Guardians actually show up. And they never are actually a team. It's just kind of them. They happen to be in the same area as one another. Fuck all this. I didn't give a shit about this. I couldn't make heads or tails of what was going on at any given point, mainly because I didn't care. Anybody else got anything on this?
Hey, we got Yondu. We got Blue Merle in here. Sure. But he was orange on the cover, blue-ish in the issue. We didn't get a lot of him. This was not the best debut issue as far as introducing your characters and concepts. I feel bad because Arnold Drake is a writer who best known for Doom Patrol and co-creating Deadman. But his work here is not a very readable comic. They kept the Guardians of the Galaxy trademark imprint long enough for them to find a workable concept, which was not a far-flung futuristic team like this or even the Jim Valentino Guardians from the early 90s, but the Dan Abnett, Andy Lanning Guardians that became the movie. So, you know, this introduces – there's not a whole lot of links between this team and the team that millions of American and worldwide movie lovers know. But hey, it's a catchy name, Guardians of the Galaxy. There you go. Yeah, we had – Vance Astro, sure. Charlie 27, yep. 27, 23, Charlie, and Martin X, and Yondu. That was it. And, you know, I don't care about any of them at this point. Does anyone?
Not really. Charlie 27 was – I was having, like, weird Uncanny Valley feelings just looking at him, as he said. And he – because he is the Jovian from Jupiter warrior over thousands of years, or I guess another 1,000 years, has evolved to become very block shaped, and
because Jupiter's big, you see, and it has heavy gravity.
It's got heavy gravity, and it's just kind of upsetting. We get Yondu's here, so there's maybe, I guess that's the only real, even tenuous link that people who are familiar with today's Guardians of the Galaxy might draw to this first appearance. Martin X, maybe he was a cameo in the second one. I don't really remember.
The character Michael Rosenbaum played in the second one, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay. Wasn't Stallone supposed to be Vance Astro or something?
No, he's Starhawk.
Starhawk.
I don't fucking know.
Starhawk, who does not appear in this issue.
Okay.
We do not get Starhawk. We do not get another character.
There's a female guardian, too.
Nikki.
Flame hair.
With the flame hair, yeah. Even if you are familiar with maybe an 80s or a 90s iteration of the Guardians, you still aren't getting a lot of that in this first appearance. And I don't know, where are they going? Sort of feel, sort of a Buck Rogers serial throwback thing where they're gathering the team and it's high adventure, but it's really not all that exciting. Don't know that Gene Colan is maybe the ideal artist for this type of thing. I feel like he's been mismanaged because he's better than much of the stuff he's had to work on.
He's not on Doctor Strange or Dracula yet.
There you go.
That really plays to his strengths. Gene Colan draws in a very smoky style. He was a great, great, unusual artist, but this was not, like you said, playing to his strengths. But, you know, he worked fast, I suppose, and competently enough that he was on books like Iron Man at this time.
Yeah. He loves those long vertical layouts, too, where you're really, like, if you're reading this on a computer screen, you're kind of finding yourself scrolling in a way that you don't necessarily do with traditional, like, 4-to-6 panel grids, right? And,
A lot of the panels are kind of angular, too.
Very angular, yep. And again, I don't know that style really suits the tone that they seem to be going for here. But I had very, very, very low expectations coming into this. I'd never read it before. I mean, I've kind of familiar with the broad strokes of this team and these characters, but I did not expect much and did not get much. So it was whatever. I mean, it's just 20 some pages. It's not the worst thing in the world. It's certainly no Hulk Annual One.
Apparently Ving Rhames' character in Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 was supposed to be Charlie 27. I just looked that up.
Oh, okay.
But I guess they just chose Ving Rhames because he already kind of looks like a human blob, as opposed to like me done that way through CGI.
He can't really move anymore, right? Like they don't have him doing anything in is that who I'm thinking of in the Mission Impossible movies?
Yeah. He's in the Mission Impossible. I had not heard this tale of Hollywood rumor and innuendo, my friend.
Well, just that he has some mobility issues. I mean, I'm being kind of an asshole, but he doesn't get around as well as he used to. Which, I mean, I don't see this Charlie 27 character getting around so well the way that he is proportioned. So that may fit.
Apparently, he had to change his name when he stopped moving around so much. He used to be known as Vic Rhames.
My lord.
Stop podcast.
Well.
Your thoughts on Marvel Superheroes 18 and the introduction of the Guardians of the Galaxy, or the original Guardians of the Galaxy.
I don't know how to follow that.
Can you?
What are we doing?
Well, if we're going to go for deep cuts, this might make Nick laugh. I could have waited just 3 more years on this one, or set it like 3 years ahead of this to the year 3010, because then we would have seen Brian Boitano defeat the Robot King and save the human race again. Apparently, if you're born on Jupiter, you can be an egg and a superhero. Humpty Dumpty is what I referred to him as, like, throughout all of this, because I just wasn't going to remember Charlie 27. I mean, how bad have things gotten where we're now attaching numbers onto the end of names? That's whatever. And that's how I felt about this whole book, is very whatever. Although I will give it one thing that was kind of sort of interesting before it became irritating. And that was the panel layouts. They're done in this weird angular style at times, that at first is kind of eye-catching. It's like, oh, well, this is different. This is something that we've not seen before. It's getting a little hard to tell just exactly what order some of these are supposed to go in as a result. So now it's just irritating. That's about it. You won't care about any of these characters. The long-ass backstory that they go into in the middle of the issue for the thousand years. I guess it's the thousand-year-old man whose name escapes me at the moment.
That's Todd Weber, 22.
Yes. That's, as I said, you start attaching numbers to the backs of people's names, I'm just going to forget. He's the dude wrapped in a purple condom. And he is incredibly...
Dance Astro.
Yep, he is incredibly uninteresting, as is the rest of this book. So, nothing else really to add to it. The artwork, not bad, not great. And I don't really think we're going to be reading about any of these characters ever again.
Well, we will read about Vance Astro in the pages of... Well, should I spoil it, Tim, or should we let Ben talk about it?
Well, we've acknowledged that it's something Ben would be very interested in.
It is.
I think we've done our work.
Okay.
So let's just leave it at that.
Okay.
And something I'm pretty interested in, too.
Yeah, and one of my favorite comics of its time. Yep. I did forget that, this is 1969, so we're kind of in the peak of Star Trek. There we go. Star Trek was kind of running down its original TV run, 66 to 69. Plus, you had Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes. So you had the futuristic concept going on over at DC.
And that was a big book for college and high school age kids at the time. So maybe they were trying to get some of that market, trying to plot out the future of the Marvel Universe. They really hadn't done a lot of that at this point, but they should have done it with a little bit more foresight than they did with this particular execution of a comic in the Guardians of the Galaxy.
The Badoon have conquered much of yet the again. Solar system. Yeah. From Silver
Nobody
Surfer.
Cares about the Badoon.
The Badoon.
I'm going to be honest. I spaced out while you guys were talking about this book because I cared so little. So I hope we're done now and we can move on to something better. Because while Guardians of the Galaxy and Marvel Superheroes took us to the cosmos for a shitty book, Thor would take us to the cosmos in 1969 for a pretty good run of issues. So for this year, we read 160 through 162 and also 168 through 169. I think the reason that it's broken up like this is because these are the issues that directly involve Thor and his conflict with Galactus. So when we first find him here in 160 through 162, Galactus has arrived, has discovered the living planet Ego and is planning to feed upon him. Meanwhile, Thor has been tasked to help out this alien race known as, I think it's the colonizers here. I can't remember the specific name of the race.
Rigellians. That's a callback.
Yes, Tana Nile, who has appeared before in the pages of Thor. So it kind of turns into this like a comic book triple threat match between Thor, Galactus, and Ego at one point. And predictably, maybe it's Stan continuing to deliver with the great Shakespearean dialogue, or maybe it's the continued outstanding art from Jack Kirby to include that. I don't even know what did we decide we were calling that effect, that the photorealistic effect. Help me out, I guess.
Photo collage.
Yeah, the photo collage. All this stuff here is used to expert effect. I loved these three issues, but that's fairly predictable coming from me, the massive Thor fan. So what about you, Todd? I know you are probably anxious to praise some Jack Kirby here.
This is wonderful shit. I could read this. This is like the best Thor I've read to this point. And especially the Odin angle. Mm-hmm. I think Odin stuff rings more true. You really get a sense of the relationship between Thor and Odin, and almost like this, the condescension between Odin and Thor is just awesome. Thor is a book about father issues. I do like the introduction of Galactus in a new setting, although we don't have a herald for Galactus just yet, and yet he's being very successful finding planets to eat. So, we should have a herald. Maybe is this the one that has Baldur on Earth, or is that the second half of this run?
The second half of this.
We got a lot of I think Warriors 3 was in that second half too, but this is more about Ego and these this race that helps him and then ends up settling on Ego is pretty funny too to me. I've just enjoyed this tremendously. I could reread these. I wish I had the originals for this, but I'm really happy that I've been able to check them out on Marvel Universe, because this is kind of like I'm not going to say Pete Kirby, but I'm going to say Kirby kind of towards the end of his first Marvel run, and he's getting a lot. You can definitely tell Thor and Fantastic Four have been his favorites, but I kind of like the dynamic action where he gets to focus on one character more in Thor, and it's going to be a sad day when we get to a year where there's no Jack Kirby. This is Lee and Kirby riding Thor, checking all of the boxes that you expect, but in maybe a more cosmic way than you're used to in Thor. I'm not nuts about the Rigellians, but they have an establishment in Thor. At least we've seen them before in this book, and so we kind of recall them. But yeah, I think the Odin stuff in these first three books is particularly strong.
Yeah, including Sif begging to go to Thor's side, and Odin basically saying no because I said
say
so.
You nay.
Yeah, and having no real rationale for it. So that was great. Tim, what did you make here of these first three Thor issues that we read?
Yeah, real good stuff here. I like that Odin material too, and I'm glad that we're talking about that a little bit, just because I don't know that we've gotten a ton of exposure to just Odin's basic character, even though we have covered a good bit of Thor so far. But yeah, you open with that scene in issue 160 where you've got Sif pleading with him to go to Thor's aid, and he's like, no, that's not going to happen. The recorder is there auditioning to be a sex bot, it seems like, in Odin's court. Not really sure what the significance of his presence there is, but brings him back into circulation. So you just get a sense of what, like, Odin's day-to-day sort of is like administratively, which was sort of funny and welcome at the same time. But I really admired the commitment to showing just how expansive this world is, where you've got Asgard, you've got the Rigilians, who I'm also not crazy about, but you know, we're just going all over the place, and Ego comes back around, and I swear that it may sound nuts, but I think when Kirby cuts loose on Ego, that's my favorite Jack Kirby.
It's like, pretty awesome.
His weirdo, like, Ego designs and the photo collages, the way he puts those to use with that character and that very out there concept, just so does it for me. Kirby is making very liberal use of splash pages throughout these issues as well. And it reads sort of more like a modern comic now, where just in terms of the pacing, in terms of the layout and the writing, it's getting closer to that. This is what you expect when you open a comic. It's not so dense. It doesn't take you 45 minutes to read. And I'm not saying that's that in a bad way. It's just, it's closer to what the modern reading experience is like. So yeah, got a lot out of these. Interesting that we see this fight between Thor and Galactus, and Thor being kind of as successful as he is on his first outing.
Uh-huh.
In a way, that feels like doing a dream wrestling match without like a huge build, you know, just sort of throwing it out there on free TV. But we know the story is not over, which is good. You see Thor really able to cut loose and show just how not to be fucked with his when he really has his back to the wall. And it's just a nice hero moment for him. He's assuming that role of protector and defender and just, you know, the nobility to that character. Just a good distillation of what iconically the Marvel Universe Thor is at his best.
Well said, sir. Well said. Russell, your thoughts here on these first three Thor issues?
You guys covered it all pretty well. The Kirby art is just something to behold. He's on top of his game with these three issues. And we've already, like Tim called out the Ego design and how Kirby renders all of that, and it looks really great. But I'm struck by how he designs spacecraft, because it all looks so different from what I'm used to. Like, I guess it's because even in the modern era of spacecraft design, we're still getting stuff that tries to play off of pretty traditional aircraft design. So it's all a little aerodynamic, even though it's space, that's pointless. Kirby doesn't really seem to go for that. He has very rounded style ships designed for these alien creatures. And that's something that I really appreciate, is that all of this stuff feels very alien. It doesn't seem like anything you would see on Earth. It doesn't remotely feel like anything that you've ever seen before. The creature designs, all of it. I mean, this is some pretty out there imaginative stuff, and is just, you know, mind-blowing to look at. Even if the story wasn't any good, art would be worth it just for how gorgeous it is. Luckily, the story is actually really, really good. So we've got this big, you know, fight that's coming between Thor and Galactus. We're getting a little bit more. We're getting teased with Galactus's background, and I'm kind of two minds about that, but I'll talk about that when we talk about the last three issues. Overall, yeah, this is the stuff you came that you came for whenever you're going through this reading list. These are easily the best parts of what we've read so far in 69.
Absolutely. So let's not hesitate to move right on to the next two Thor issues we read, which also heavily feature Galactus. This involves Odin sending Thor out to find Galactus. Seemingly, at first, Thor thinks it is to do battle with him, but it winds up Odin is just kind of looking for more information on Galactus. And we kind of get the true origin of Galactus revealed to us here in these two issues. Meanwhile, on Earth, you've got Baldur the Brave now on Earth, and he's being joined by the Warriors Three, and we get to see Volstagg trying to use Earth furniture, which is always good.
Yes.
You have lots of cool comedy bits with Volstagg and the Warriors Three and Baldur on Earth, which I always appreciate. So kind of a minor backdrop in these two issues, but something that I really enjoyed. The Galactus stuff, as always, drawn by Jack Kirby, outstanding. Kind of cool to see a more in-depth origin for this character after so long of him being kind of this big bad for the Marvel Universe in general, pretty much since his creation. So, yeah, I loved these two issues. Maybe not as much as I loved the first three, but I loved them a whole hell of a lot. Tim, how about these two issues for you?
I will say that while I don't mind in general the use of comedy relief cutting between settings and scenes in the way that this story does, where you've got Thor and the somewhat cosmic elements doing whatever he's doing and then whatever's going on back on Earth. But in this type of story, I think tonally it was a bit of a miscalculation. I mean, we're getting a pretty big fucking revelation in Galactus's origin. And then it's like, meanwhile, on Earth, we see Red China creating the Thermal Man and the Warriors 3 trashing Donald Blake's office. And it's just sort of like, could we kind of stick with our main event here? Like, do we really need this stuff in this issue? Not that it's totally unwelcome. I didn't want to see – like, I wanted to skip over those parts so bad because I was very hooked and very tuned into the Thor Galactus stuff. So minor nitpick there, but wanted to just point that out, being who I am as a person. But this Galactus origin is interesting to me because I don't think it will stand. Doesn't this get retconned later on?
In, I don't know if it's the last Galactus story or quote unquote the last Galactus story. I think in Fantastic Four they add on to this or they change it. He doesn't end up being just like this. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a Silver Surfer type story here.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. I think he's still from Ta. They tie the Watcher into it a little bit less, but I'm sure I could research it. But I don't think it sticks, but it didn't make me go, this is wrong. Everything I know is wrong.
Yeah, yeah, right. I mean, I know he gets an actual name from his former civilian life later on. But anyway, there's sort of more story to be told here. I always think it's funny seeing Galactus doing, like, ordinary things. And here we see kind of a pensive and melancholy Galactus, the existentialist, where he literally, like, takes a load off, he sits down, and he's like, come sit around the fire, and I'm going to tell you this story. And it's just, I don't know, it's just funny to me, that visual. So, yeah, it's a fine, although it is just basically all Galactus backstory, works very well for what it is, because I think there is a natural curiosity around this character. And yeah, pretty cool stuff. And we also learn that Galactus is an emotional eater, that he is racked with pain and anger, you know, at all times when he is not feeding. So
what must that be like?
Relatable.
Same.
Hard. Awesome. And that is all.
Todd, do you have anything else you wanted to add here on this two-parter?
You know, Galactus should shut up. There should not be any talking Galactus ever.
Galactus doing ordinary.
Galactus should never, ever speak ever. People should speak about Galactus. You know, it's been established that you see Galactus as kind of the your god, as your the image you were created out of. And different races see him as, you know, alien scrolls see him as kind of like an nth scroll. But he shouldn't speak ever. Sometimes he has pants on. Sometimes he's wearing a toga. Sometimes his colors are purple. Sometimes his colors are pink and blue.
Sometimes he's a diarrhea cloud.
Sometimes I feel like I don't have a partner. This is an interesting comic or series of comics, 68 and 69, where you get this backstory of Galactus that is very weird. That you've got Thor and Galactus having a one-on-one conversation. I kind of like the Earth stuff too, with Baldur, the Warriors Three, and then this Loki / Carnilla alliance going against them, and then Thor eventually joins them. And we even see Thor turn into Don Blake and do something useful, because he's the lame Don Blake, but he still picks up a dude, right? At the end. Or is that 170? That might be 170 I was looking ahead to. Yeah, that's 170, where we get to more of the Thermal Man from China. Weird comic, but not bad. I think 160 to 162 are still better. This does mark the last inking job for a guy named George Klein, so I want to just kind of bring attention to that. He was a guy who did a lot of Golden Age and uncredited stuff. He was actually the inker for Fantastic Four number one for Kirby. Here he's got a little more of a heavy line, kind of like a Joe Sinnott line. But so I still prefer, say, Vince Coletta's inks on Kirby, but Klein's art did the job here. Definitely let Kirby's stuff shine through. But yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing maybe a revised Watcher origin in the future. All right, Galactus origin in the future.
Outstanding. Russell, your thoughts here on these two this two-part Galactus origin bit?
Yeah, pretty much in line with the rest of the guys. I think it was you know, continue to be well done. The Warriors 3 stuff was odd yet funny. So that kept it from, you know, being just absolutely skippable for me. Volstagg's continued journeys to using Earth-based furniture are certainly unique.
It was a defect with the wood.
It was a defect. It was the wood was absolutely defective. I totally believed him. But when it comes to the Galactus origin, that it did feel like something that just didn't seem right. Like, from my own knowledge of Marvel, I was thinking, you know, that feels like something that's not going to hang around terribly long. And the way I feel about Galactus' origin is pretty much how I feel about giving a definitive origin to Wolverine. I feel like it takes away some of the more important aspects of the character. I feel like it diminishes the character more than it elevates. Because that mystery around the character is what kind of makes them intriguing. It helps to add depth to them in a way that, you know, a lot of other characters that we've read up to this point just will never have, because we have definitive origins for them. But when it comes to Galactus, I love thinking of him as simply a force of nature. He simply is. And that's how I always like to think of him, as this, you know, celestial being who has always been there. Galactus will always be there. And it's, we don't know why it's important for him to exist, but he's going to keep existing, and there's nothing we can do to really to stop him. And that's kind of what resonates with me about that character. And while I appreciate the conflict, especially between Thor and Galactus, and more so Odin Galactus, I feel like, you know, we didn't need the in-depth origin for the character, and I'll be curious to see how that evolves going forward.
Interesting. Yeah, it will be something interesting to track because, you know, Tim and Todd both have already said that's probably not going to stick or won't be sticking as we move forward. Well, that actually brings an end to our reading list this time out. Be sure to stick with us and come back for our next episode. We'll be covering the second half of 1969. Just go ahead and tell you real quick what we'll be covering on that episode. We'll have Captain America 113 and 115 through 119. That's right. We're going to skip one issue. Why? I don't know. Captain Marvel, number 17. Avengers 67 through 68 and 70. Again, skipping a random issue. Why? I don't know. And Uncanny X-Men 60 through 63. So, yeah, good list of stuff to get caught up on if you want to read ahead and then listen in next time. So before we let you go, let's end every show as we always do by having people go around and plug their shit. Todd, plug your shit.
At Todd Weber Guitar on Twitter. Subscribe to Place Be Nation Pop on iTunes or wherever you get fine podcasts, because I produced almost all of those and I put them up and I schedule them, and we appreciate your listening. And be listening for Conversation Comics in the near future. I had to sigh and think about it. I've got other irons in the fire, but let's talk about Conversation Comics coming soon, relatively soon.
That's exciting news. Exciting news. Tim, is this news you were aware of?
It's not, but I just want to say that I would love to join Todd again for Conversation Comics. However, I also do not want to hold Conversation Comics hostage. So if Todd would like to do anything with Conversation Comics at any point, with or without me, I will not be offended. It's a great show. And
well, I'd like to let Tim know that I'm no quitter and I like to see things through. So if somebody could tell Tim that I'm not going to do another Conversation Comics without him until this Byrne Claremont run is done on X-Men, please let him know this.
Well, you know, I'd like to let you both know that if you just wait long enough, we'll get there eventually on Marvel Age. But that's neither here nor there.
I'm hearing that sources tell me Todd Weber doesn't wish to do an episode of Conversation Comics until the Byrne Claremont X-Men run is complete. So Todd and I are going to figure that out and awesome. And get an episode scheduled out here soon. How about it?
How about that? Hey, sorry, Chicago Bears. Oh, whoop. Sorry. Wrong podcast.
Oh.
What else you got, Tim?
Okay, so on Place Me Nation Pop, I co-host Talking Pop with Jennifer Smith. We will do a January episode. That's all I will say. And on Place to Be Nation Wrestling, recently dropped survey says episode 20, we are covering Clash of the Champions, the 9th edition of that series from 1989. It's New York Knockout. Cool stuff there. The Flair Funk I Quit match. So check that out on the wrestling feed, Place Be Nation Wrestling. You can find me on Twitter at Cyke68, CYKE68. And I think that's going to cover it. Yeah, that's all I'm going to say.
Awesome. Russell, plug your shit.
You can find me at Russell_Sellers on the Twitter machine. And you can listen out for my other comics podcast, the DC Post-Crisis Management, which just dropped its Infinite Crisis episode recently with one Ben Morris. And we'll be recording another episode in the fairly near future with a special guest who is going to help me go through Final Crisis. That's going to be fun.
What if we killed Batman and sent him back to the ancient history?
Yep. That Scottish accent will be coming along with me as well. Yes, all of that is happening. And then, of course, you can check out my brand new show, 90 to Nothing, with my co-host Sam Neely, as we do a retrospective on 1990s movies. We did episode 1 on Home Alone back in December, and a new episode of that will be dropping later this month, as we just watched that 1998 teen house party classic, Can't Hardly Wait. So,
Russell, I'm getting word from the home office that that episode actually dropped before this episode of Marvel Age, so people should check it out.
Oh, I had no idea that that was happening. Okay, I'm behind on the scheduling, so go check out episode 2. It's a lot of fun.
Wow. Late breaking news here on the Marvel Age podcast. <That's right. laughs> You can, of course, find me on Twitter at NickDuke87. I'm part of the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. You can listen to me here on Marvel Age. And, of course, over at the longest running weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation, the Hard Traveling Fanboys, where we just dropped an episode dealing with Avengers Infinity War, taking a look back at that as part of our Hard Travelers for Hire ongoing series, which is nearing its end, actually. We only have a few more of those left to go. We're going to wrap that series up with the release of Avengers Endgame at the end of April. So looking forward to wrapping that up here in the coming months. With all that being said, guys, I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Marvel Age podcast. Be sure to come back next time for the second half of our discussion on 1969 in the Marvel Universe. Thanks for listening. Enough said.